just enough water, just enough wine, just enough crumbs, a dollar and a dime, just enough hope to keep us toeing the line. But sooner or later, it all back. Will they keep us separated by the shade of our skin?
Well, that marvelous song is Sooner or Later by Eliza Gilkinson. We use it as the introduction to Activist Radio, where we have a little bit of history we don't think you learned anywhere. We have at least three news stories we haven't seen on TV. And we offer some music to help you join the resistance. Activist Radio can be heard Thursdays, 5 to 6 p.m. on WVKR 91.3 FM at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. Thursdays from 7 to 8 p.m. on WBDY, that's 99.5 FM at the Bundy in Binghamton, New York. Sundays, 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. on WESU, and that's 88.1 FM at the Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. Sundays 4 to 5 p.m. on WIOF, and that's 104.1 FM in Woodstock, New York. And Sundays 5 to 6 p.m. from the Progressive Radio Network, and they're at prn.live. Past programs are available as a podcast. Just search for Activist Radio on iTunes, Google Play, Digital Podcasts, Stitcher, any number of ways to sign up for Activist Radio as a podcast. Or you can listen to us anytime you want. Go to classwars.org. Our last 10 programs are there, along with a bunch of information on what we did during the program and some of the background of the guests. So there's a lot of information at classwars.org. Check that out. Our guests today are going to be Kwame Holmes. He's a faculty advisor to the Bard College Prison Initiative. And Shianna Lowe, she's an advocacy officer at Defense for Children International. And they discuss what they call the systemic mistreatment, abuse, and arrest of Black American and Palestine youths in their respective countries in the U.S. and Israel. And this is a panel that I helped put together. In fact, the discussion starts with me introducing both people on the panel, and I've always actually wanted to play this this panel, and I've never gotten around to being able to play it until now. So we're going to take a look at what we've done. This is pre-recorded from a panel we did about a year ago. This brings me to the views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, its board of directors, or its constituents. It's just the views of me, Fred, and I bring you up to date on America's hidden class war.
Be louder than your screams. The people's day will come. Emma Goldman, I sang this song for you. Big Bill Haywood and Mother Jones too. Psycho and Vanzetti, they took your lives. But we can organize. One day our whispers will be louder than screams.
Well, that's The People's Day by Otis Gibbs. We've played quite a bit of Otis Gibbs in the past. He's a great progressive songwriter. Not all his songs, of course, but he really has some good ones. and the People's Day, I think, is one of the, his best ones. We use it as the introduction to the first part of Activist Radio. We call it History You Didn't Learn in High School. And it's part of the history of struggle, how minorities resisted occupation in the past, how people discovered the ways to make our society a more just and equitable experience for all of us. So the history is left out because our corporate media doesn't want us to think that we can possibly change anything. All right, we're going to go back in history now to November 10th, 1898. And that was the day that white supremacists murdered African Americans in Wilmington, North Carolina. In fact, it was a coup that deposed the entire government of the city that had been elected just 2 days before. That was, of course, under Reconstruction. That morning, early morning, several fires signaled the beginning of the assault on black people. But by sundown, the city's black newspaper, that was the Daily Record, had been burned to the ground. As many as 60 people murdered, mostly African Americans. The entire city administration was replaced by white supremacists, and the thriving black community was essentially destroyed. Well, the Democrats, the party of the defeated Confederacy, had promised to bring an end to what they called, quote, Negro domination, unquote, in the 1898 elections. They enlisted three types of supremacists: those who could write articles in the newspaper, those who could speak in front of large groups, and those who could ride with what they called the Red Shirts, an armed version of the KKK. An editorial by Alex Manley, the editor of the black newspaper, was the spark. He had responded to a speech made in Georgia promoting lynching as necessary, quote, to protect women's dearest possession from the ravening human beast. And of course, that's the core of all racism, isn't it? It's sexual anxiety. Possibly of being replaced by men of different race or religion or ethnicity. Well, the white supremacists then organized rallies calling for death to black voters. The Red Shirts patrolled black neighborhoods, threatening to shoot African Americans on the way to the polls. After the election, a mob of 2,000 armed white men burned the newspaper, burned the black newspaper, and soon invaded black sections of the city. And the Wilmington Light Infantry participated as well. They had a wagon with a Gatling gun, and they brought that to the battle against blacks. After the riot and the coup, thousands of blacks simply left the city. In 1900, the North Carolina legislature took away black people's right to vote. The white citizens of Wilmington would go on to pass what they call the, quote, the White Declaration of Independence, unquote. Assured that, quote, we the undersigned citizens do hereby declare that we will no longer be ruled, we will never again be ruled by the men of African origin. Well, just listening to this, we see the reflection of Trump's hatred of black people. But also, it's similar to the rule by blacks. We won't be replaced. A lot of this language is really straight from the Trump agenda. And you can trace it right back to the a country's history during Reconstruction and the end of Reconstruction, when very unwisely the Northern armies were pulled out of the South before blacks had really achieved solidarity or equality with whites in the South. And when Union Army pulled out, that's when this racism could come to a head. And this Jim Crow era has never been widely covered in our schools or in our media. I wonder, are the specifics just too painful? Or do they call into question the basic fairness of our society? Maybe they just bring up the question, why has no one ever punished for this massacre? Why has no one ever gotten their houses or their businesses back? Well, you can say that these things happened in a very few places, but you would be wrong. The Zinn Education Project has collected at least 75 massacres in U.S. history, all involving Black or Native American victims. Don't think there were that many. Check out the zinproject.org, and that's Z-I-N-N-E-D project.org. Zinedproject.org. But going past the infamous massacres, we come to another realization. How did the northern towns all across the country end up so white, while many of the cities ended up with large Black ghettos? In the Hudson Valley, we have a number of, I would say, lily-white towns, Rhinebeck, Red Hook, Cold Spring. And our Black populations are concentrated in Poughkeepsie and Beacon, Kingston and Newburgh, small cities. But I think we'll save the Jim Crow history of sundown towns in America to another time. It was an era when Blacks were pushed out by thousands in rural communities by sundown town laws and by white supremacy mobs. For violent racism has always been with us. It's part of our DNA as a slaveholding country and an ever-expanding military empire. We're going to go to a song now. This is by Eric Bibb. The album is Migration Blues. The song is Brotherly Love. Let's listen to that.
I still believe we can find a way. To live in peace, I do. How about you? I don't agree. With the doomsayers who have no hope. No, I don't. How about you? I believe we can save our ship, though it's sinking. I believe we can change the way we've been thinking. And before it's too late, replace fear and hate with brotherly love. I still believe we shall overcome. Our selfish ways, oh, I do. How about you? I just don't see all the work we've done has been in vain. No, I don't. How about you? I believe we can save our ship, though it's sinking. I believe we can change the way we've been thinking. And before it's too late, replace fear and hate. With brotherly love, brotherly love, brotherly love, brotherly love. Brotherly love.
They lied, they took us for a ride. Tried burying the truth where it very nearly died. They lied, but no matter what they tried to hide, sing and shout, the truth wins out. Everybody knows they lie. I ain't telling you nothing you don't already know, but the government's been lying to you.
Well, that's They Lied, Jay Mankita. We use it to introduce the next part of our show. Even has its own website, fantasylandmedia.org, where we take an in-depth look at what we think are the drawbacks and the failings of our corporate control media. We think a lot of it is because the people in charge are the people in charge of our media as well. That's the CEOs and the corporations, the politicians who are in the pocket of the corporations, and your very own government. All right, our first story today. And again, like last week, we're going to look at some stories that have come out within the last year to see if they were actually carried by the major U.S. media. At the time we reported on the story, it wasn't covered. And this is take a quick look at to see if these stories eventually appeared in the U.S. Press. The first story is from Plus 972. It's an Israeli newsletter. Quote, even Israel's European allies aren't buying its attack on NGOs, non-governmental organizations. On July 12th, nine European governments declared that they had rejected Israel's designation of six Palestinian civil rights groups as terrorist organizations. The announcement is a major victory for the organizations themselves, for political activists, and for the Palestinian communities they serve. Following the declaration by Defense Minister Benny Gantz outlawing the six NGOs last October, the European donor countries opened their own investigations to look into Israel's allegations. Nearly 9 months later, they concluded that, quote, no substantial information was received from Israel that would justify reviewing our policy, unquote, toward these organizations, and such they would continue to fund and collaborate with the groups. A close look at the NGOs targeted by Israel shows that they were not chosen by chance. Adamir, for example, provides legal advice and representation to Palestinian political prisoners. Al-Hag has filed submissions to the International Criminal Court, ICC, regarding alleged Israeli war crimes and crimes against humanity. The Union of Agricultural Work Committees helps farmers survive attempts to expel them from Area C of the West Bank. and the Defense for Children International, Palestine, documents and conducts U.S. advocacy on Israel's systemic arrests and abuse of children. Well, the story was posted in Israel in July 2022, but since then, most of the U.S. media has remained silent on the issue. I think they prefer to let this attack on the six human rights organizations disappear from view by not following up, by not essentially reporting on it. The second story is from Stop the Wall. On June 1st, 2022, dozens of Israeli soldiers and JCB, Volvo, and Caterpillar bulldozers raided the villages of Al-Fahit and Al-Makez and demolished seven residential tents and animal shacks, leaving families along with their herds homeless. This is the second time these families lost their homes in less than a month. On May 11th, 2022, the Israeli occupation, Volvo, and JCB bulldozers razed 19 homes and animal shacks to the ground. Insisting on keeping their land, the owners of the destroyed homes rebuilt them again, some of which were among the seven demolished homes yesterday. Classified as a firing zone, the expulsion of the eight communities would be culmination of decades-long apartheid and settler colonial practices in the area. The forcible expulsion of these communities paves the way for Israel to annex Masafar Yatta and further consolidate its illegal settlement enterprise. Land confiscation included through the pretext of, quote, military needs has been highlighted by the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights as one of the salient features of Israeli apartheid. Villages in Masafar Yatta, such as Am Akor, have been highlighted in a case study when Amnesty International did their groundbreaking report on Israeli apartheid. JCB, the world's largest construction company, is not only used to destroy Palestinian homes. The company exported equipment to Israel is also used to construct illegal settlements, settlement and industrial zones, and apartheid infrastructure in the occupied West Bank and Syria and Golan Heights. JCB machines were involved in the construction of the apartheid wall on stolen Palestinian land. According to WHO's profits, the British-based company's track and wheel excavators and wheel loaders were documented during the construction of the wall near the Palestinian villages of Al-Jawa, Anata, and Bet Jala. Well, this story, again, is from earlier this year, June 2022, and it really reveals how complicit the British and the U.S. companies are in the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. They produce the equipment, right? Since that time, the story just hasn't been picked up by European or American news media. That's why the Israeli ethnic cleansing goes relatively slowly. You have 10 families here, 15 families there. It's really a gradual elimination of the Palestinian people, their homes, and their culture, aided in part by our own media, which refuses to follow stories like these. Why isn't the U.S. media reporting the stories showing the construction companies and the equipment companies, the British and the U.S., being used to destroy Palestine, housing villages in Palestine, and really promoting the ethnic cleansing that's been going on for the last 70 years. Our last story is from The Intercept. Quote, a Republican-backed super PAC on Tuesday fell short in its bid to intervene in a Democratic primary against Pennsylvania State Representative Summer Lee, a 34-year-old black woman and rising star in the party, who fended off a tsunami of outside money to best anti-union attorney Steve Irwin. And the spending from a GOP-backed super PAC linked to AIPAC, and that's the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, left Irwin behind by less than 1,000 votes. Another super PAC in Oregon, funded by the cryptocurrency Fortune and organized around the project of pandemic prevention, Protect Our Future, spent some $10 million to boost Carrick Flynn, while the super PAC linked to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, House Majority PAC, it was called, also dropped $1 million into the race. It backfired, and local Democrats as well as national progressives, including the Congressional Progressive Caucus and the Working Families Party, rallied behind State Representative Andrea Solanas, who appears poised for a victory. And in North Carolina, the super PACs had better luck, spending $7 million against former State Senator Erica Smith and Durham County Commissioner Nita Allam. The spending came from AIPAC, the Democratic Majority for Israel, and mainstream Democrats. The super PAC organized and funded by LinkedIn co-founder Reid Hoffman. Well, this story goes back to May of 2022 and really exposes, I would say, the hidden role of Israeli-linked super PACs in promoting not progressive candidates, but right-wing candidates in the U.S. Other mainstream media have not followed this story since. I think it's a big deal how the Israel lobby spends millions trying to get rid of progressive Democratic candidates. In fact, the Israel lobby is so close to the ultra-conservative, right-wing, white nationalists that it's really frightening. I think the Israel lobby is a hard-right organization. We have talked about it spewing Islamophobic ideas of racial superiority. I think it belongs in the category of Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, dangerous enemies to our democracy. Well, we have a couple of possibilities. I think we're going to do a song now. This is by Leon Bridges, and the song title is Sweeter. Let's listen to that.
Hoping for a life more sweeter. Instead, I'm just a story repeating. Why do I feel skin dark as night? Can't feel peace with those judging eyes. I thought we moved on from the darker days. Did the words of the king disappear in the air like a butterfly? Somebody should hand you a felony. Cause you stole from me my chance to be. Hoping for a life more sweeter. Instead I'm just a story repeating. Skin dark as night. Can't feel peace with those judging eyes. sophomore heater.
All right. That was Leon Bridges, and the song was Sweeter. That is a sweet song. We have a couple of minutes left before we get to our guest today. And I'm going to read you part of an article I wrote in the LA Progressive last year. It was entitled The Unspoken Spread of Fascism. On the surface, Mussolini's rise to power in the early 1920s had little to do with corporatism. It was based on squads of black shirts that murdered thousands of socialists and unionists all across the country. And Hitler employed very similar tactics starting in the late 1920s, using his brown shirts, well, to beat and torture, assassinate anyone who opposed his Nazi agenda. Less recognized, however, is the fact that both terrorist organizations had elite corporate sponsorships. For Mussolini, that support started as early as 1922 and remained consistent until the end of World War II. For Hitler, corporate money came later in 1928 after he'd purged the socialist elements of his party. While Gentile's definition of corporatism, and that's what the article is actually written about, how did fascism get defined and who gets to define it? While Gentile's definition of corporatism did not include payoffs by the rich elite to Mussolini, the support of this class proved to be a critical piece in his ascent to power. And the same is true for Hitler. Before 1928, his lack of funding was a constant impediment to achieving complete control. After that date, the major corporations saw Hitler as a way to destroy unions, end socialist resistance, and ensure profits. Is this same phenomenon at work today in paving the way for Trump's rise to power? An interesting Market Watch study conducted 2 years into Trump's presidency found that despite his reckless behavior and contempt for democratic processes, the nation's top CEOs were giving almost 3 times as much to Republicans as Democrats. And that just scratches the surface, since most donations to major parties come from company PACs and dark money, controlled in large part by the same CEO class. In the 1920s, it was similar to the last decade in several ways. Industrialized countries saw a rich elite prosper greatly during both periods, giving them much more money to influence their political systems. At the same time, economic discontent became more overt as the majority of workers became unable to support their families. Rage at the system became a distinct threat to the very wealthy. Have the CEOs and the very rich in our time reacted in the same way as they did in the 1920s? Are they in fact funding authoritarian leaders who will protect corporate profits, using racism and nationalism to turn anger at the system into anger at immigrants, minorities, anyone who disagrees with them? By avoiding the use of the word fascism, mainstream media analysis fails our democracy in 2 ways. First, we as citizens can't look at Trump and judge him by historical standards. His actions may be outrageous, deplorable, but we remain oblivious to the pattern of a fascist leader that he exhibits. The second way that the media fails us is to limit how fascism is described. It's always a person rather than a national movement, a Netanyahu rather than the Israeli people, or a Hitler rather than all Germans. Fascism may be encouraged by someone with the right combination of charisma and viciousness, but in the end becomes a social illness that moves whole populations towards war and genocide. Perhaps fascism is the madness that comes from true corporatism, or from its most recent manifestation, That would be neoliberalism. It is the deadly mix of greed at the top, misdirected rage at the bottom, and a fascist leader who can turn it all into an engine of mindless destruction. There is no need to review the obvious dangers that such societies pose to our species and to our planet. All right, we're going to go to our two guests, Kwame Holmes, a faculty advisor to the Bard College Prison Initiative, and Shana Lowe, advocacy officer at Defense for Children International. And this is a panel that they both got to speak at, introduced by myself. So let's go listen to this panel that brings up this connection between the oppression of Black Americans and oppression of Palestinian youths in Israel-Palestine. So let's go to that.
All right, my name is Fred Nagel, and thank you for joining us today for Children in Detention, an Introduction to No Way to Treat a Child campaign. And thank you to our two panelists, Kwame Holmes, PhD scholar in residence, Human Rights Program, Bard College, and Shana Lowe, U.S. Advocacy Officer at the Defense for Children International Palestine. Thanks to the four groups who sponsored this event, that's Jewish Voice for Peace, Hudson Valley, Middle East Crisis Response, Veterans for Peace, Women in Black, New Pulse. And thanks to other groups that have come together to tell their members about this event and to support us in other ways. So thank you. A little history. We came up with the idea of the meeting our local House Representative Antonio Delgado about what we thought was systemic mistreatment, abuse, arrest of Palestinian youths. And we scheduled a time with him several months in advance. In our preparation for the meeting, we started a petition urging him to become a co-sponsor of House Resolution 2407 that ended U.S. military sales to countries that abuse children. We also attended some of his local town meetings. We were lucky enough to be called on. Several of us asked questions, and they were about Palestinian rights and the treatment of Palestinian children by Israeli police. Many of us have actually voted for him in the election, and we're hoping that he would actually come out with a progressive stance on Palestinian human rights. But his town hall answers were not that encouraging. In fact, I asked a question about Palestinian children, and he did nothing but talk about Israel's right to defend itself. And at the end of maybe 10 or 15 minutes, I couldn't remember one time when he even mentioned the Palestinians. Moreover, after these meetings, I don't think it had anything to do with our questions, but Representative Delgado canceled our meeting and said if we wanted to talk to him, it would be through his aide instead. So we decided to make a campaign out of his refusals. We thought he was running away from this issue. Our online petition had reached 2,000 signatures, very close to 2,000, and we asked all our signers to call his D.C. office about H.R. 2407 and urge him to become a sponsor. We also videotaped the statements we were planning to make to him, and we put that online for everybody to see, the 2,000 people. In our campaign to get Representative Delgado to sponsor this legislation that protected children, we came to the realization that we ourselves live in a society that does very similar things to people of color, especially children and young adults. I've worked in public schools most of my career. My one example, I think, was reading about how many police are in the New York City public schools, thousands, and how many arrests and summonses they give. Hundreds and hundreds of arrests are made within that New York City public schools, and 90% of the arrests are Black students. And, you know, since I've worked so much in education, I contrast this to the white schools up and down the Hudson Valley. How many white students have been arrested at school? I have only, to my knowledge, only one in a school I worked for was arrested, in fact, in school. So, in fact, this panel is sort of the result of our acknowledgement that racist mistreatment of youth is rampant in both Israel and the United States, and there are connections between them. You know, from the training of police forces to the apartheid nature of both societies. And our hope is that we will come to learn how to really combat racism by understanding these common threads. So we have a little housekeeping. Let me review just briefly what's going to come up. After the panelists have made their initial presentations, Margie Leopold will ask some pre-written questions of the panel. Then Felice Gelman will ask some written questions from your chat list. So if you're interested, down at the bottom there is a chat list. Type your questions in there, and we'll try to get to a lot of the questions before the end. So that's what we're hoping that this is going to be like. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining us. I think we're going to have an interesting and a truly rewarding panel from this. So let's go to our first panelist, Kwame Holmes. Would you join us?
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much this is my opening statement, yes?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Lovely. Thank you so much for inviting me to be a part of this event. I want to echo Fred's acknowledgement of Women in Black, Mideast Crisis, Veterans for Peace, and Jewish Voice for Peace. And I am especially excited to be a part of this because of the real moment of possibility that I think we all are finding ourselves in, unexpected possibility around opposing abusive policing practices and mass incarceration and thinking about what could be the alternatives for a different type of future. Though I think in order to do that effectively, we have to also look backwards. And I'm a historian by training, and particularly I'm a historian of modern America. And what I've been most interested in is trying to understand what we got right about the civil rights moment, the liberationist movements of the 1960s and 70s, and also how that moment made this one possible, created a set of political trends and cultural hegemonies, you could say, that have made it possible for the police to engage in such intense mistreatment of juveniles, and particularly of African-American minors. So I just wanted to very quickly talk about my broad research project, which is not in and of itself entirely concerned with juvenile justice, but which has some implications for its application. Again, as I mentioned, I'm interested in an understanding the implications, the long implications of the civil rights era. And one thing that I argue in my work is that the civil rights era helps us to understand a huge part of the culture of neoliberalism. And I know that this is a word that is used exhaustingly and can be exhausting to hear over and over again, but I just want to talk very briefly about what it means for me. Neoliberalism being that move towards the marketization, the privatization of public services, right, as a kind of form of governance, but also a cultural move wherein the logics of the market come to be understood as the only acceptable premises for governance, and where market rationality and an emotional rationality in general become the only means to create legitimate political discourse. So what we see emerging out of the civil rights era is the ascendance of African-American, white, gay, and lesbian feminist movements, which are able to achieve all sorts of new access to education, white-collar jobs, positions in government, provided that they operate within a certain emotional bandwidth, a kind of non-strident, rational comportment and set of political demands. And the reason why I've raised that issue is because, and I think why it's so relevant to this topic, is because the moves that are made that I look at in my work that have produced such disparate outcomes in the application of juvenile justice since World War II were, yes, in part predicated on sort of wild racial stereotypes like the super predator, right, which we saw Hillary Clinton's use of that term quoted at ad nauseum in 2016, but were also made through very quiet bureaucratic administrative processes that were quite invisible to the eye, and which all often had to do with how racial minorities were categorized psychologically and emotionally in different ways than white children. And so that sort of interest in the emotional realm as a means of understanding politics and as sort of locating those policies which otherwise are kind of hidden from view is a huge part of my research agenda and what I think I'd like to share more about during the Q&A. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Kwame. And Shayna, your opening remarks, please, would be great.
Great, thank you. So I echo Kwame's thanks for all the sponsoring groups and for bringing together this group of, what are we at, 49 participants right now. So it's really a pleasure to be virtually with you. I wish I could be upstate in the Hudson Valley and not in Brooklyn, but this is the best we can do for now. So as Fred mentioned in his opening remarks, I work for an organization called Defense for Children International Palestine. We're a local Palestinian human rights organization. I am one of a handful of staff that are located in the US and the UK who support our Palestinian team on the ground in international advocacy efforts. And we've been instrumental in helping Representative McCollum introduce both the previous legislation she had in the past Congress, HR 4391, and this current piece of legislation, which the folks up in the Hudson Valley have been advocating around, HR 2407. So I just want to briefly give you a window into kind of what is going on the ground with Palestinian children in detention and give you kind of an understanding of the legal framework that we're operating in. So since Israel occupied the West Bank in 1967, there really have been two sets of laws that have been operating at the same time in that territory. There's Israeli civilian law, which applies to Israeli Jewish settlers who are illegally living in the West Bank. And there's military law, which has been imposed on the Palestinians living in the West Bank since almost, we're right at the 53 anniversary just a few days ago with the Six-Day War. What this means is that And just to kind of frame it in terms of thinking about the conversations that are happening in the US right now, those of us that are angry and frustrated about police practices, we're realizing that these decisions are made at a very local level. And so there are efforts being made to put pressure on local leadership to change the laws and change the way that they're applied in order to have more equity. This is not the case in Palestine. In occupied Palestine, a military general writes the laws and that's it. Children who are arrested in the West Bank are automatically tried in military courts. Military courts are not meant for civilians, let alone civilian children. These are courts where children are deprived of basic due process rights. The child's experience in detention begins at the moment of arrest. In our documentation, and I should have mentioned, we've been representing Palestinian children since 1991. And my boss in Ramallah just told us that we estimate that we've provided legal assistance and legal aid to around 5,000 Palestinian children in those in just under 30 years. So for most children, their arrest begins actually at night. Two-thirds of the children we documented last year were arrested in night raids on their homes. So I just watched a Vice News special about Breonna Taylor and saw a video of an execution of a no-knock warrant and was struck by the similarities in the tactics and the just like devastating impact that it has on a family. That's the moment where a child realizes that their home is not safe and their parents can't do anything to protect them. Children are then bound and blindfolded. Over 95% of children experience this. Their hands are tied behind their backs with zip ties. And then they're taken frequently to a number of stops, Israeli settlements, before they end up at an interrogation center. They have no right to access to counsel when they're being interrogated, no right to have access to their parents when they're being interrogated. Even in the rare cases where children are issued summonses to show up at a military base or an interrogation center, their parents are turned away at the door and the children are brought in. Trials are held in military courts overseen by judges who are impartial. And what we see is widespread ill treatment and even torture of these children, ranging from physical abuse. About three quarters of the children report some type of physical abuse, either after they've been arrested or during interrogation. Psychological abuse, the use of coercions and threats. And most of these children are charged with minor offenses like stone throwing. And they can be arrested not necessarily for having, you know, thrown a stone at a specific time in a specific act, but just on the suspicion that a child may have thrown stones at some point. What we see is, and what we learned through our research when we started representing these children almost 30 years ago, is that we started hearing that we're hearing the same stories over and over and over again about ill treatment, children put in stress positions, children put in solitary confinement where they have no idea what time of day it is, where they're given horrible food to eat and not given proper medical care. And so that's really what led to us evolving from a legal aid organization to doing documentation of these abuses to demonstrate how systematic and widespread and institutionalized they are. I think we're seeing here in the United States, people are finally waking up and realizing that police brutality is not an isolated incident. It's not a bad apple on a police force. It's a culture of impunity that allows law enforcement to abuse their power with as we saw in the case of George Floyd, where I just read today about the numerous calls to 911, calling the police on the police. There's just no, there's very little means for people to agitate and make change without getting broader support. And that's why we work on the bill in Congress, we engage with UN actors, and we do other things to put pressure on Israeli authorities to end these systematic abuses. So I think I'll end it there and can expand more in the questions. Thank you.
All right, our guests were Kwame Holmes, faculty advisor to the Bard College Prison Initiative, and Shanna Lowe, and she's the advocacy officer at the Defense for Children International. And today this panel that we did about a year ago discusses the mistreatment, systemic mistreatment, abuse, arrest of Black American youths and Palestinian youths in Israel. And I think the drawing of the links between experiences here in the U.S. and in Israel is very informative because it reveals a caste system often denied in both countries, but really apparent to anyone looking closely at their lives, being a black youth in America and being a Palestinian in Israel puts you in the very lowest of classes, where you have very little rights, very little opportunity, and often you end up in prison or shot. Activist Radio can be heard Thursdays 5 to 6 p.m. on WVKR 91.3 FM at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. Sundays 4 to 5 p.m. on WIOF 104.1 FM in Woodstock, New York. And Sundays 5 to 6 p.m. from the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. Past shows can be heard on ClassWars.org. Please like our Facebook page, read our ClassWars blog for commentary on today's interview. We'll be here next week at the same time to help you become part of the resistance.